I was watching once a TED Talks, and the guy that was giving the TED Talks, here was his story. He was working in the ER, in the emergency room, for many, many decades. And he was saying that for the first many years of his career working in the emergency room, guys, come take a seat, be comfortable. It's going to be at least a half an hour. For the first many years he was working in the emergency room, so he said, you know, people that work in an emergency room, there's a situation that comes up, hopefully not often, but fairly often, is that you see a patient coming in, and you know by looking at the different signs that they're experiencing that they're going to die, and that they have 10, 15, 20 minutes, but there's nothing that you can really be able to do to save them or help them, and you know that they're going to die. And there's nothing in the medical literature, nothing that he was taught, he said, that told him, what do you tell the patient when you know that you can't help him and you know that he's going to die and these are his last few minutes alive? So what he chose to do for the first many years of his career was not say anything at all. He thought, first of all, it was very uncomfortable. I don't know how to say to them. He's a complete stranger. And I don't know how he's going to take it. Maybe he's going to start, you know, getting angry at me, pulling out wires. You know, he's going to get all flustered. So I would just ignore it, and I wouldn't tell them the truth. I would make it like we're taking care of the situation and everything will be okay. Until he said, one guy came in, he was just in a motorcycle accident, and he knew that this guy was going to die, but he was still conscious and talking. And the guy in the motorcycle accident turned to him and looked him straight in the eyes and, you know, caught his attention and said, "Doctor, am I going to die?" He saw from the activity around him that might happen. And whatever it is, the sincerity of the person made him feel like, I have to be honest, I have to tell him the truth. And he said, "Yes, you're going to die in about 15, 20 minutes. You're going to pass away." And he said, and that guy's reaction just shocked me completely. It was not at all what I thought would happen. He suddenly became very peaceful and passive and contemplative. And he was thinking, and he started talking about very meaningful things for the last few minutes that he was able to. And from then on, I decided that it's not fair for me to withhold that information from a person and not to tell them that you are going to be dying in the next 10, 20 minutes. And from then on, in the last decade or two, I have been telling people that I knew were going to die that they're going to die. And I was shocked to find that it's not at all like what you see in the movies, that when somebody is about to die, they start to freak out and get angry and upset. But he said it's quite the opposite. Almost every single time I've noticed three regular responses that almost everybody had when they found out that in the next few minutes you're going to be dying. And one of those responses he said that he saw was that almost immediately people would start to list all of their regrets, all the things that they wish they had done in their life that they never ended up doing. And he said it didn't matter how old they were. Even if it was an 80-year-old man, a 90-year-old lady or whatever it is, suddenly they would start to say, like there was an old man, he said he knew he was going to die, and he told him, and immediately the guy said, "I wish I wasn't so involved in my business and in my money. I wish I spent more time with my kids and my grandchildren." And there was somebody else that said, like, "I wish I didn't yell at everybody so much. I wish I was nicer to the people that worked for me." And he said, it's not like it didn't even take them time to think about what they wanted to work on. They knew it at the top of their head, like what they never got around to doing. And it just now they knew they're about to die, it just like came right out. They didn't have to like sit and do like, you know, self-contemplation and analyzing and remembering all the years of their life. It right away they just blurted out, "These are the things that were wrong with me that I never got around to." So he was confused at why is it that happens. There was another talk that I saw. Basically what happened was, somebody told me, you know, when you're preparing shmuzes to give to guys at Shana Aleph, maybe it's good to check out TED Talks. They'll always relate to something in one of the TED Talks. I was looking for something inspiring, so I wasn't finding anything inspiring, so then I typed in the search, death. And then all of a sudden they started getting inspiring. So that's why these examples came up. So another talk that came up was a guy that was, it was like a famous story that happened, I don't remember how many years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago, where there was an airplane that crashed into the Hudson River. So everybody was on this airplane, and the oxygen masks came down, and they knew they were going to crash. So they knew they were going to die. You can't usually talk to somebody about what is it like to be in a plane that's crashing, because nobody ever makes it out alive afterwards to tell you about what it's like to be in a crashing plane. This plane actually landed in the Hudson River, and the water protected them. I don't think anybody ended up dying. So he came and he spoke in the TED Talks, and he said, what did it feel like as the plane was plunging straight down, and like he knew that in a few seconds, everyone's screaming around him, and he knew that he is about to die. And he said right away he started to regret how much he yelled at his kids, how much he yelled at his wife. He wishes that he showed them more love. He wishes that he was like a kinder husband and father and everything. And then he made it out alive. But the memory of how strong his regrets were stuck with him, and he started to work on himself. And that's what he came to speak about. So why is it that this happens? It's so strange. It doesn't make any sense. If people know, if you would ask them what's the most important thing, that would probably be on top of their list, and yet it's the thing that they never got around to. It's a thing that you have to wait 80, 90 years to find out that you're about to die till you start to like feel really bad about it. So how does that happen? Why does that happen that we sometimes don't get around to the things that we would put at the top of our lists? How does that make sense? We're going to return to that, and now I'm going to ask another question. Why is it that for marriage you need a commitment? Why is it that for marriage you need like something contractual? When you learn Maseches Kiddushin one day and talks about how a man and a woman get married, you don't see a talk about love anywhere in that whole Maseches. And so much of marriage has to do with love and sharing and giving. So why is it that when you're learning Maseches Kiddushin about how to get married, that doesn't come up? What comes up? What are the components of the commitment? How do you make this something solid that and what is everybody chayav to each other? Why is it like that? And the reason why marriage is the foundation of marriage is commitment. Why can't it just be that two people say, I love you, you love me, we want to have kids together, let's just get an apartment, live together, and have kids? Like, why do you have to make a ceremony? And why do you have to sign contracts? Why do you need an act of acquisition? Why do you need a commitment? Why can't you just say, let's live together, and then just continue with that? Why does it have to be something formal? And the reason for that is that human beings realize that one of their biggest weaknesses is that they can't trust themselves. That they don't always end up doing the things that they want to do, and don't always do the things that they decided that they were going to do. They don't necessarily get around to it. Just because you want something, but each day you do what you're feeling that day. Each hour you do what you're feeling that hour, and you don't necessarily stick to it. So when you're marrying somebody, you don't want it to be that, you know, the reason why they're marrying you is because they love hanging out with you and you're so much fun to be with and they're so attracted to you. Why? Because who says you're still going to feel that excited or those things are still going to be there in a year or two or five or ten from now? If the basis of our marriage right now is your feelings, the fact that you love me, what happens if one day you don't feel like you love me? Then you're just going to leave me? I don't want to get into a marriage that's based on your feeling. Human feelings change from day to day, from year to year. How can I depend that your feelings will be that way forever? I don't want to go into something unsteady. I want something that's a commitment that's always going to be. I want to know that the kids that I have with you are going to have us together all the time, that you're not going to divorce me, take my kids, and I'm going to get to see them every other shot. I don't want to go into something with that being a high risk. So therefore, I want a commitment. I want something that a person feels bound to, regardless of how I feel down the line. We're not saying that everybody that gets divorced is doing the wrong thing and that it's never appropriate and things like that. But what we're saying is that when you're entering a marriage, we want that the foundation of it, what it stands upon, more than emotions and more than love and all that, because that changes and you can't depend on that all the time, is commitment. That I'm committed to making this work no matter what, and it's not based on how I'm feeling that day. And that's how we're meant to get ourselves to do the things that we want to do. When a person, if we realize our weaknesses, that we don't always get around to the things that we want. So what we need to do is we use our free will to remove our daily free will. What do I mean? We decide that I'm committing myself to this goal. Whatever it is, each person decides what's the goal, the thing they want to work on, the thing that they want to accomplish. And to get to that goal, I know that every day I need to do blank, 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 blank. Or I'm not allowed, I don't let myself do blank, 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 blank. And you, everybody fills in blank what based on what their goal is. And now you're committed to that, where you don't have to each day rethink or make a new decision. Am I going to go there? Am I going to do that? Am I going to learn for that hour? Am I going to wake up at this minute or whatever it is? No, because you made a decision that you, and you like made a commitment, a contract with yourself that you're going, that now it can't be any other way. I took away my free will with that decision that I'm not going to redecide every day what time I wake up, or if I do this, or if I do that. I am committing myself to this decision, and I'm no longer going to make a decision every single day. Because if every day I make a decision, it's going to be based on what I'm feeling that day, and then a person goes up and down, never gets to do what they were hoping to get to accomplish. Another phenomenon that I want to discuss is the concept of now and later that human beings use. The concept of I'll do it later that we all use is the most comforting situation possible. When you say, I'll do it later, I'll get around to it later at some later point. So it's the best thing, because you don't have to feel guilty because you are going to do it, and it's so comfortable because you don't have to do it right now. So the nicest thing is to say, I'm going to do it later. So you're excited because you're going to do it, but you could still have fun and or right now because you don't need to deal with it now. And then what generally happens is that we say later, and later, and later, and later, until a person is 80 years old and finds out they're about to die and realizes there is no more later, it's over, and now I regret that I never ended up getting around to blank, 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 blank. Now that doesn't only happen in a person's lifetime. At the end of situations that are become permanently over, that always happens. You know, let's say at the end of every year, I'm here now, I think it's my 18th year or something, at the end of every year, so you have a regular thing. It's like the same way that every year when Shana Aleph comes, certain situations always come up and everybody does that and everybody does that. So the end of the year, a very common thing that happens all the time is about 3 or 2 or 1 day right before yeshiva's over. Usually as people are packing up and their room starts to look like what it looked like when they first came, they start to realize, it sinks in, oh my gosh, the year is over. We just got here. Like, how did it suddenly end? And they start coming to the rabbis or writing themselves letters, crying and frustrated. I never did this. I never did that. I thought I planned on my year in Israel being like this. I wanted to come out like that. And like all of a sudden, so how did that happen? If that was so important to you, that's why you came here. And it was something that was so important to your life. Like, how did it happen that only 2-3 days before you're leaving, all of a sudden like it hit you that you never ended up doing it? And the reason is because of the things that we discussed. First of all, distractions come up day to day. It's always a new one. In the beginning of the year, everybody has to do blank. Afterwards, you think that's going to go away? When that stage goes away, then everybody has to do blank. And then everybody comes to visit from America for a couple months. And everybody gets taken out to, you know. There's always going to be distractions throughout the year at all the different stages where it enables a person to keep on saying later, 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 later. And then what happens is either it gets too late, you don't end up doing it, or as it looks like the amount of time left is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and you start to feel like it's less possible to do what I had planned or wanted to do, you start to make your goals smaller and smaller and smaller based on the amount of time that's left. So you either change your goals and they become smaller, or you just keep on pushing out because you don't want to deal with how it feels like to, you know, to have let something very valuable slip through your fingers. So what we need to do in all situations in life, when we have goals that we really want to happen and they're very important to us, is first of all not let ourselves rely on the later, because the later never goes away. We always will say later. I imagine if we would do a study, the things you say later about, usually a person doesn't end up doing. And to commit ourselves to things, marry ourselves to decisions of how I'm going to run my day. What are my green lights? What are my red lights? What do I let myself do? What do I not let myself do? In a way that will make sure that I get to the end goal that I want to end up getting to. Because if I just kind of hope that it happens and like plan on it happening and say later and not necessarily today, it really might not happen. And the year is almost over. You're feeling like it's the beginning of the year. The year is literally almost over. Before you know it, you're going to be like, I can't believe it. It's true. I remember a lot of guys came to me at the end of the year. I said, Rabbi, when you said that in the first shmooze, like, the year is almost over, I thought you were crazy. But you just said that yesterday. Like, it's so weird that the year is actually almost over. It flies in a second. One year is very short, and it's exciting. So there's always new things coming up. So it makes the year, you know, go faster and faster. Each day might be really slow. My God, the Gemara's never ending. I can't wait till the Seder ends. But the weeks and the months really, really fly by. So catch it. Like, don't let ourselves say later, 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 because it really might not end up coming around. There's a Gemara that talks about how a person lives an average life. This was back then. But an average life is considered 70 years, and more than that is already considered arichos yamim, like living an extra long life. So the Gemara wants to show like how much a person is actually, though, awake and accomplishing things. And it subtracts all the hours that a person usually sleeps, and it subtracts all the hours that it takes to daven shacharis, mincha, maariv, all the hours that it takes to eat the, you know, 2-3 meals a day that a person eats, and it's left and with a certain number of hours. And if you smush it all into, if you'd be awake straight the whole time, a person is alive for 12 years out of those 70. That's what the Gemara, there's a Gemara in Shabbos that tries to calculate how long is a person actually alert, accomplishing, and doing what he's here for? 12 years. So I tried to use that same concept, because it helps you like really realize like how much time you're working with, on our year in Israel. Okay? And if you were to take, what? Yeah. If you were to take, somebody, can you press that green button and see if it turns out fine, and that green button? And if you were to take, we have right now, let me just see where I wrote this down. We have right now, between now and Pesach break. Okay, now and Pesach break, how many Shraga days? So if you only count Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, which are like the regular yeshiva scheduled days, and you subtract out the trip days and the vacations and Friday and Shabbos, so there's 125 days. Okay, 125 days. Every day, we have 9.5 scheduled Shraga hours. Nobody did 9.5 hours yet. In other words, and I bless it upon you that you will do 9.5 hours. It'll be a huge accomplishment. But 9.5 hours is you're probably doing now, if you really look at how much time you're actually learning, not schmoozing, not going out, not this, probably, okay, fine. Maybe 3, 4, 4.5. But imagine it was 9.5. If we're working with a 9.5 hour deal, okay? 9.5 hours a day for 125 days is 1,187 hours. Divided by 24 hours, it's 49 days. So you have 49 days of Shana Aleph that we're working with, of alert, awake hours, if you use all those 9.5 hours on the Shraga days. And then it's Pesach break. After Pesach, very short this year, and very few people really just turn around and pick things up after Pesach. Then we'll give you a shmooze, how, no, you could and you should, and it's true. But now looking ahead, you don't want to wait till after Pesach to grow. So we're working with 49 days. It's not a lot. And it really is almost over. Another thing I wanted to talk about. And this is, you know, maybe first like a side point, there's a parenthesis, because it doesn't have to do with this schmooze. It has to do with any schmooze that any rabbi gives you this year. Just, and I could have said this before, everything I could have said this in a different schmooze, just something that I want to make sure is said. And somebody keep your eyes in the air conditioners when we could get some colder again. That you have to understand the challenge that any rabbi speaking to a big group of people has when they're speaking. Because really it's 100 or so individuals, every person holding in a completely different place with a different background, holding different religiously, different emotional capabilities, different things they have to grapple with. And yet you have to speak in a way that will, you know, speak to everybody and not turn anybody off and not push too much and not push too much, and it's like a hard challenge. So every rabbi usually will mess up different times where this guy came out turned off, this guy came out angry, that guy came out like, what do you mean he's not pushing us to do anything, uninspiring, and it's a hard challenge. So what you need to do in the situation of listening to the Rebbeim giving shmoozes and things like that is know that really, the shmooze is a starting point. You're meant to, after, let's say Rabbi Schneider gives his life-changing Thursday Parsha shmooze, whatever it is, it's a starting point. It's meant to get you to start thinking. Talk to the rabbi afterwards as an individual, and then he can help to individualize it towards you. If you hear something like ringing a red bell by you, no, this is not me, this is turning me off, He didn't mean it for you then. He's trying to help. He's trying to help you build. If you see instead it's destroying you, getting you angry, turned off, he never would have said it to you. He's trying to speak to the group, and those mistakes happen. Take from it what does apply to you. Take from it what will help you, will be constructive for you, and don't put up walls and let things turn you off. Realize that it's a challenging position to be in when you're speaking to a big group of people. That was a side point I wanted to say. Last point that I want to talk about before we break, and that is this: it's Elul, and you can't not talk about it. You can't not refer to Elul. We've been hearing the shofar blowing now, the Ashkenazim and Sephardim too. I think maybe during Slichos they hear it. We hear it at the end of Shacharis, but we have been hearing the shofar blowing every day since Rosh Chodesh Elul, and it's not just there's a halacha you have to blow the shofar in the morning, and we were yotze hearing the shofar in the morning. They're blowing the shofar because they're trying to wake somebody up. They're trying to wake us up. So if we just make sure we hear the shofar, say our L'David Hashem Ori, which you're supposed to say in the month of Elul, that's not what Elul is. Those things show us that, wait, there's something going on right now. We're at a different period of time. In other words, we might be caught up in finishing camp and starting yeshiva, but there's a whole other schedule going on in the Jewish and the Torah calendar, which is we're in the month of Elul, we're blowing the shofar, and we're leading up towards Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And the idea of the blowing of the shofar is to get a person's attention. So we want to tune ourselves into that. What's the idea of blowing the shofar? So, sometimes you hear different music or different songs, and it elicits different emotional reactions or awakens certain memories of things, right? Sometimes you could smell something, it reminds you of people, reminds you of a feeling that you felt when that smell was around or whatever it is. So there's a pasuk in the Navi that says, when a shofar is blown in the city, is the nation not going to be shaken up? And we could hear that. And that pasuk is brought in the halacha when it says why we blow the shofar. And how many people are actually trembling when we hear the shofar in the morning? I'm not trembling when I hear the shofar in the morning. So what the pasuk says, and you're going to hear a shofar, you're not going to tremble? So what is it talking about? So let me explain to you what I learned, what I heard, that one of the mafarshim, one of the rishonim, explain. We're living in a different century, but bring ourselves back to the time where there was no electricity, and there was no sirens, there was no television, there was no iPhones, and so what would you would have a city, and let's say there was an impending danger to everybody in the city. There was the enemy army was coming upon the city from far, or there was a fire spreading around all the wooden houses in the village. How would you get everybody's attention, because we're in a state of emergency right now? How would everybody get to know? So there would be a guard standing on the city walls, looking all the time, if the enemy is coming, or watching over the city if there's some fire, because fire spreads really fast. We need a lot of help fast to put it out. Otherwise, all the houses are going to be ruined. They would blow a shofar. They would blow a shofar, and they would do certain sounds with that shofar. I don't know if you've ever been in Israel at a time of a siren. But we've had it a bunch in the last, since I've lived here, in 18 years, it's 20 years, it's happened a whole bunch of times. My wife grew up with it, she was during the Gulf War hearing the siren a lot. When you hear, and hopefully it shouldn't happen this year, but if you ever hear a siren, so right away your heart starts to thump. And there was a lot of psychology put behind the tune of the siren. You've ever heard the siren that goes off in Israel when there's a missile that's coming in? They made it specifically a sound that makes you nervous. They don't want it to be something relaxing, like the Shabbos alarm that goes off on Friday. You'll hear whatever sound. But it's not like that. It's something like that goes up and down in a way that makes you nervous. They want you to be nervous when there's a missile coming in, because they don't want you to just stay sitting and doing whatever you're doing. They want you to run to the bomb shelter. They want you to run to where their instructions were to go to. So they made a sound that makes you nervous, that makes people run, so that they go to the places that they're supposed to be going to. They want to get your attention. If you were to see somebody during a siren playing on their phone, not going anywhere, so you would say, that's stupid, you're missing the point, you got to save yourself, you're caught up in something that's getting in your way, that's not going to help you, that's not going to do anything. There's a siren, you have to wake up, you have to take care of things. If the houses are burning down and you're just sitting there So you would say that, so the idea of a shofar was meant to elicit the feeling of when you're in a city and the feeling you have in a state of emergency. We need everybody's attention. Whatever you're doing is unimportant compared to what's happening right now. The enemy nation is coming. There's a fire spreading. There's something that you have to focus in on right now, and everything else has to go. And the feeling in Elul, blowing the shofar every single day, it's meant to wake us up in that way, the tune of it, the idea of it, to focus in on Rosh Hashanah is coming, Yom Kippur is coming. You have to start thinking about how you're living your life. What are you doing? What do you need to work on? Are you pushing things off and not getting around to it? It's like the shofar is blowing and saying, now, 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 not later, later, later. Now, 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 deal with it. It's, you know, don't just push it off. It's concerning. Your life is passing away. Things like, so we have to hear the message of the shofar. It's not just enough to you know, listen to the shofar say L'David and run down to breakfast, but to take it to heart, to react based on it, to do something based on it. I was thinking to myself, I don't know if I should add this in, but just like a fun, interesting thought. Hopefully nobody has the answer to this question. It's a question I have. What happens in Israel when, in the clubs, when there's a, when all of a sudden one of these sirens go off? Like there's a missile coming and a siren goes off and they hear the siren. So obviously they stop the music and everybody runs to shelter in Israel. But then what happens after that? Like it's so weird, like they go back and then get back into the mode again, or like everyone just goes home, like calls the night. It's like too weird. Like they just were worried they were gonna die. Okay, coast is clear, then they just go back and like ease. I imagine the party's over. I could be wrong. I don't. Nobody tell me the answer if you know it. My guess is that the party's over, but I could be completely naive. I was once on an airplane. It was so freaky. I mean, it was like not just turbulence. It was like literally up and down, up and down. My heart was sinking. People were starting to scream on the plane. I was saying to Hill, and people started screaming on the plane. Now, right before this happened, I was in this uncomfortable seat. There was like in a row near me, there was a lady sitting amongst a bunch of guys and they were not acting appropriately. There was a lot of giggling, laughing, flirting, and they were drunk, and it just was uncomfortable with everybody in that area of the plane. Suddenly, when the plane started to go like that and people were screaming and shouting, I was saying to Hillel, so this lady started to say, she was Israeli, Elohim lo, Elohim lo, 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 Elohim lo, lo, lo. She was like davening to Hashem. I remember thinking to myself, okay, Hashem, like, I hope this stops and I don't die. But I wonder what she's going to do when this, like, relaxes. If the turbulence stops and we make it through this, like, what's going to happen? And the turbulence stopped, and she went back to what she was doing before, and so did they. And that was like, it was so, I don't know, it was upsetting, and I didn't get it. I didn't get it. Like, when your life is being shooken up, you're talking to God, you want to live, like, to do important things and not to, you know, like, not to miss out opportunities. And then to go back to doing things like that, like, right after you thought about what's life all about, why am I here, like, it's almost over, and then to right away fall back to that, that's like, I guess, you know, hearing the shofar and not moving, not changing, not making, not taking something upon ourselves or making a decision based on it. So we should hear the sounds of the shofar. We should blow the shofar within our own hearts. We should commit ourselves to a specific plan of how we're going to get to the goal we're going to get to. And we should be zocher that, Baruch Hashem, we really are in the beginning of the year still. It hasn't yet slipped through our fingers. We shouldn't let the 49 days of Torah Chag that we have until Pesach slip through our fingers, but we should be able to squeeze out from it the most that we possibly could. Everyone can take one more cookie until it finishes.